We're going to listen back to an interview with the British actor Pete Postlethwaite. He died of cancer yesterday at the age of 64. Americans came to know Postlethwaite through the 1993 movie In the Name of the Father, for which he earned an Oscar nomination. In 1994, he co-starred in The Usual Suspects, playing a mysterious and sinister character named Kobayashi. Steven Spielberg called him probably the best actor in the world after directing him in Amistad and The Lost World, Jurassic Park. His recent films include Inception and The Town. Postlethwaite had a face that made an impression on you. An AP article described it as remarkably craggy and time-worn. One critic described his cheekbones as boiling out of his head like swollen knuckles. His voice made an impression, too. He could play very vulnerable or very tough, as in this scene with Ben Affleck from Affleck's film The Town. Postlethwaite played a crime boss in a working-class neighborhood. Affleck worked for him pulling heists. When Affleck tells Postlethwaite he wants out, Postlethwaite threatens him and tells him how he ruined the life of Affleck's father.
Play the horses? You know, they either geld a horse with a knife or with the chemicals. And your daddy said no to me. I did him the chemical way. Gave your mother a taste. Put the hook into her. Ah, she doped up good and proper. Hung herself with a wire on Melnair Cass. And you, run around the neighborhood looking for her. Your daddy didn't have the heart to tell his son that he was looking for a suicide doper who was never coming home. If there's a heaven, son, she ain't in it.
Pete Postlethwaite in a scene from last year's movie, The Town. I spoke with Postlethwaite in 1997.
You're from a working-class family, I believe, in the north of England. How were you exposed to acting? Was it mostly through movies, or did you actually see a lot of theatre where you lived?
No, I didn't see a lot of theatre to start with. I suppose it was pictures, really. Saturday morning cinema and things like that. We used to go and see Tom Mix and Hopalong Cassidy and things like that. But I suppose in terms of, I don't know, I mean, maybe something to do with the Catholic background. And, you know, being an altar boy, you know, being on that altar, you know. It's a bit like being on stage, you know. Maybe there's something in that. I don't know. And then at grammar school, I started to do a couple of plays. We did The Importance of Being Earnest, I remember, and A Man for All Seasons. Quite enjoyed that, doing those kind of things. Then I went to college and read drama and PE, a strange mixture, physical education and drama. And drama eventually took over. It was at the time, the late 60s, when there was some extraordinary writing coming out of England. Plays by Pinter and Beckett and all these guys were all writing these extraordinary plays like Waiting for Godot and Look Back in Anger and stuff like that, all happening at the same time. And I thought, blimey, this is extraordinary stuff. So I really enjoyed all that, but then thought, well, you still can't go and be an actor. I mean, people from Warrington don't go and be actors, really. So I decided to carry on. I'd teach for a couple of years and then see what happened after that. And if I still fancied it after that, I'd go and do it.
So you taught physical education?
No, I taught in the first year, actually, when I left. I taught, really, it was hardly teaching. It was in what we call an approved school in England, which is for naughty kids, really. It's for children who have find it very difficult to fit into the system and rebel against it. And that generally the schools can't cope with them, so they send them to approved schools, which they were then. So that was more like social work than teaching, even though I was, you know, employed as a teacher. And I did that for a year and then went to a girls' convent grammar school, would you believe, in Manchester, and taught 1,000 girls a week. Drama, that was. I was a member of the English department to start with, an English teacher. On the staff, and the staff was massive. There's 77 on this staff. It's a big school. And I realised there wasn't a drama department, so I thought, well, I'll create a drama department and then I can be head of it, really. So that's what basically I did. So I taught drama there. But then even after that, after a year of that, I thought, still not really what I want to do. So I went back to school. I applied back to drama school and went back to basics at the Bristol Old Vic, and left there in 1970, and now find myself in a studio in New York talking to you about it. in 1997.
What did your parents say when you left teaching? Did they think you were being unrealistic?
Yes, they did, yeah. Yeah, it took about 10 or 11 years before my mum stopped saying, well, eventually you'll get a proper job. And I think that basically came as well. These sound terrible stories against my mother, and they're not meant to be, but I think she realised the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is a massive, wonderful company in England, or can be wonderful. They can also do some awful stuff now and again. But we opened a new theatre there, the Swan Theatre, and Queen Elizabeth, our queen, came to open it. And my mother, who's my queen, I suppose, came as well to watch it. And when she saw me being introduced to the queen on the stage of the Royal Shakespeare Company, I think then she thought, well, no, yes, it's a serious job now. That's all right. That's perfectly all right for him to do. And I think, but it was strange. Yeah, I think they did. They did think, oh, well, he'll grow out of that or whatever. It was a strange choice for somebody from my background.
You really made your mark in America with the movie In the Name of the Father, in which you played the father of a young man who's unjustly accused of an IRA bombing of a British pub. Mm-hmm. And the son's family is held as co-conspirators. So mm-hmm. you are imprisoned with your son, played by yep. Daniel Day-Lewis. Mm-hmm. And it's a great role. You know, you start off in the movie looking like a real spineless guy, you know, a father who'd never stand up for himself or for his son or for anybody. Someone who'd let people walk over him. But in the jail scenes, you show this surprising inner strength, and watching the dynamics change between the father and the son in jail are just a really fascinating, very subtle performance. Tell me your take on this character, what your profile of him was when you were figuring out how you should perform in the role.
Well, he was my dad, really. He was exactly my dad. Who died in 1988, who was northern working class Catholic. But there is a breed of these people that have this extraordinary inner strength. They appear to be spineless, they appear to be easy meat, but in fact when the pressure is on, they resort to their inner strength, this resilience that they have, which is based on their values and their beliefs and what they think. And my dad and Giuseppe were very similar, except Giuseppe was Northern Irish, whereas my father was Northern English. But there's exactly the same kind of background. And there's a whole breed of these kind of men and women. And that's the kind of profile you get. You think, well, you've got to do justice to these people.
Now, you played a very different kind of character in an earlier movie called Distant Voices, Still Lives. And in this movie, you're an abusive father.
Horrendous.
And husband. And I know when I saw the movie, every time you appeared on screen, my whole body would tighten. I mean, it's like, here it comes again. So it's interesting how you were able to embody two such different kinds of fathers and husbands. And I wonder what the difference is in how you carried your own body, how you presented your own self physically in both roles, and In the Name of the Father and Distant Voices, Still Lives.
I never thought about it like that, really, but you're looking at it now, you're obviously right. Yeah, there was a difference. Strange, really, because maybe the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives was inherently weak, whether it was because of his lack of employment or his migraine or his drinking problem, I don't know, but he was inherently weak, whereas, in a way, Giuseppe Conlon was inherently strong and outwardly weak. I mean, he was ill, whereas the father in Distant Voices, Still Lives wasn't. And it's strange that I don't identify that father with my father, isn't it? But I don't. I mean, he wasn't like that.
Good.
yes. but that was actually a very autobiographical. That was Terence Davis' film, yeah?
Yes.
Directed by Terry Davis. It was completely autobiographical, I believe. Well, I know, because that's what he said. That's what he used to do. That's what it was like. And I don't know whether...
Would he critique your performance by saying, no, my father was more like this?
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah. Oh, no, he would do that, yeah. I remember one particular scene where I think the daughter, we're in the cellar, cleaning up the cellar, I think, and the daughter asked for some money to go to a dance. And I think I hit her with a brush, with a yard brush. And I sort of whacked her a couple of times with the brush. And Terry said, no, he didn't do it like that. And he got hold of his brush and he turned it the other way around where the end of the broom was, and we had this metal cage around the camera, so that the brush wax would go into the directly into the camera. And he bent this metal with this brush. I said, "Oh, Terry, come on, don't be silly. No father could do that to a... Nobody would do that to a child." He said, "No, that's what he did. That's what he did." I said, "No, do you mean that that's how it appeared to your sister as a child? I mean, with this massive thing coming out." "No," he said, "that's how hard he hit." I said, "Well, he'd kill her." And he said, "No, he didn't. He didn't kill her, and that's what he did." And you just think, blimey, where do you go from there? So I don't know. I mean, he had a lot to feel angry about his father about.
Oh, I have one last question for you.
Go on.
Now, I understand when you were co-starring on Broadway in Cyrano de Bergerac, that Derek Jacobi, who played Cyrano, tossed his nose to you at the curtain call of the last performance.
that's absolutely true.
Yeah, well, that must have been quite
absolutely
an honor.
True. I still have it. I still have it in a little tin box at home. It's still there.
Did you know that was coming?
No, not really. No, I didn't, no. Are you making sort of references to kind of, you know, catching the bouquet of the... when the bride throws her bouquet and I'm the bridesmaid. No, that did happen. That did happen on the last night. Terrific last night in New York. Wonderful.
And so where's the nose being stored now?
It's in a little tin on the shelf and with all my other little memorabilia that are about, mainly from films as well as plays. But I even have the rosette that was on my right shoe from that show now. Lots of little things, keepsakes, lots of little memories. They're all good. They all remind.
What other memorabilia have you kept from your shows and movies?
Well, I have the baton from Brastoff. I have the belt that I wore as Roland Tembo. I have the plaque from the coffin of Giuseppe Conlon. I have the rosette I wore on my shoe for Cyrano de Bergerac, the nose-catching incident one. I have lots of things. There's always something. You always take a little bit back, I think, just to say, well, that's mine.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem.
Pete Postlethwaite died of cancer yesterday. He was 64. Our interview was recorded in 1997. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.